In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa was granted statehood on December 28, 1846, 175 years ago this year. We mark this milestone at a time when our understanding of history is richer, fuller, and more honest than ever before. It's a great opportunity to learn about who we are and how we got here. To help us learn, historian Leo Landis is here. He's curator of the State Historical Museum and other historic sites in Iowa. Hello, Leo.
Good morning, Charity.
Susan Claver is also here with us, an administrator with the State Historical Society. Hello, Susan.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you both so much for being here. And we're going to get a preview of the Iowa People and Places exhibit at the State Historical Museum. We're going to talk through some of the artifacts and the things that we can learn at that exhibit. But let's start with plans for the year. The 175th anniversary of statehood is a pretty big deal. Susan, what are the plans to celebrate this year?
Well, thanks, Charity. We are excited to be marking this milestone in Iowa's history, and so wanted to take this year to really showcase various stories about Iowa's people and places throughout the year so Iowans can better understand how Iowa became a state and, more importantly, what the state looked like prior to statehood, which is part of the reason we have our exhibit spanning 13,000 years of Iowa history. So we really just are excited about the lineup of programs that we're offering, the new exhibit, and a variety of new offerings that we have coming up, including a new Iowa History Book Club. So really, we're trying to have offerings for all ages of Iowans to connect with the state's history, which is, of course, their history.
Well, and of course, the Iowa Historical Society and the museum, you guys do all kinds of educational events all the time. So Leo, History 101 is not a new program, but during this month, Iowa History Month, and during this year, I can imagine you've got some pretty special things planned.
We do. We've got a great program today talking about Ink Paducah in Iowa by Kevin Mason, a professor at Waldorf who did his dissertation at Iowa State on the Spirit Lake conflict, and so that will be archived. And then a lot of programs later through the month, the Midwestern Diet by Amia Malaya of Drake. Mike Vogt from Gold Star Museum is going to be talking later this month. Program on Abdul El Kader, the namesake for the Clayton County seat. And then later in the month, with our Iowa Stories program out of Iowa City office, we've got the Cherry Sisters on March 17th. And then we're wrapping up the month with a few other programs, but I'll be doing one with Mary Owen and Kurt Lee. Mary is Donna Reed's daughter, or the daughter of Donna Reed. And so we're going to talk about some rarely seen photographs and then the Donna Reed Show on March 25th.
So a very exciting and fun month for history buffs in Iowa. And I want to start off our conversation by talking about this moment in history, in the study of history. We'll talk about the moment in history a little bit later. But as someone who loves history, I find the time that we're living in to be very exciting because we do have much richer, fuller history, historical accounts being released, and I feel like a fuller and richer understanding of our history than ever before. Leo, what are your thoughts about that?
Sure, and that's one of the reasons why I'm looking forward to Dr. Mason's talk today, is we have a longstanding interpretation of the Spirit Lake conflict, and Kevin is looking at the environmental factors that were happening with the severe winter and the loss of native animals that affected the Sioux people, the Dakota, and other peoples in northwest Iowa. So really looking at broader perspectives, both historically what we think of and what we may have learned as young Iowans, but also you know, we are actively collecting for the recent past. And I think of that as maybe the last 30 years. So in the People and Places exhibit, maybe some stories that we haven't always told or haven't had the collections for, we're able to talk about LGBTQ stories with Jane Sage, who was a young woman from Northeast Iowa. And when she went to University of Northern Iowa, then became a member of the Metropolitan Community of Church, which was a really welcoming community for lesbian and gay Iowans, and that was the first time really she had felt affirmed. So that's one of the stories we have that maybe hadn't been included in the past.
So it is exciting. Of course, we know that some people are politicizing this richer, fuller view of history in this moment. And I don't want to dig into the politics of that right now. But I do want to just say that as someone who wants to understand our history, I think it's a very exciting time and a great time for learning. And Susan already mentioned that the Iowa People and Places exhibit at the State Historical Museum is covering 13,000 years of history. And of course, Leo, when I was a kid and I learned Iowa history, we pretty much started with the period right before statehood. and that's all we did. But of course, this land has been here for a long time. And people have lived here for a long time.
That's precisely true. And again, I understand what you're saying, not wanting to politicize things. It's important to realize that, you know, history isn't revisionism per se. It's looking at new evidence and taking in a broader, more full scope of evidence. And so those are some of the things that we try to do as historians, not just at the State Historical Society, but any good historian would do that. And, you know, when we were young, you might have been lucky if it started with a little reference to Marquette and Joliet contacting Native peoples, and then it went to Julian Dubuque, and then away we go with Iowa history. And one of the pieces in the exhibit is one we loaned out recently. It went to the Nelson Atkins Gallery in Kansas City, but then it went to Metropolitan Museum in New York, and it went to Kay Branley in Paris, and also then we loaned it to Iowa State. But it's a drawing by a Meskwaki man, Wakashashi. He was an elder, and it was what we understand to be a gift to George Davenport, the early resident, namesake of the town of Davenport. And it's drawings of creatures that were important to the Meskwaki, but also a bison hunt by Wakashashi, and then battle scenes or war scenes, two small, very, you know, personal engagements that were important to him. And there's been some really good scholarship on that in the past. We talk about it a little bit. And so these are some of the stories and the artifacts that are really important to Iowa's history and perspectives and experiences that I have to give credit to people like Jerome Thompson and the staff who worked on our You Gotta Know the Territory exhibit in the 1980s, did a great job talking about Native nations, and we're trying to jump off that and tell some more.
Well, and I know that you've done a lot of work with the Meskwaki settlement and with Native people who live here in the state today. Looking back, and we've done a show recently about Native people, a couple of different shows about Native people in Iowa, but the history of Native people in Iowa, I feel, is very difficult to put in a nutshell, because Iowa was a place that many different groups of people traveled through, lived in for part of the year. It was an important place, but it's not nearly as simple as saying this group of people lived here, right?
Correct. And that's one of the things, too. We've got a great photograph that we use on a panel of some Ho-Chunk or Winnebago women. And the Winnebagos were typically, or the Ho-Chunks were a tribe that had lived in Wisconsin primarily and still have a great presence there. But as some of the Ho-Chunks were removed, then forced to Nebraska, but there was a short time where the Ho-Chunk people had a presence in Northeast Iowa. And so the photograph we have is actually Ho-Chunk women visiting the Meskwaki settlement, or at least that's the information we have on it. So there were relationships that continued through into the 19th and 20th century between some of those Native peoples that, you know, we don't always recognize from the way we've studied history in the past.
Susan, as you look through this exhibit and think about the fact that we're starting the history of Iowa earlier than we used to from this very Eurocentric way that we used to look at history. What are some of your thoughts?
Right, Charity. And so I think, you know, the State Historical Society of Iowa, as the collector of the state's history, you know, we take our job very seriously to ensure that we're telling all history, not only across our 99 counties, but as you mentioned, the time before statehood. And so our staff of experts has just done an amazing job with this exhibit, Leo included with that, but also with our programs that we have lined up and our different offerings, because not everything can go into an exhibit, but we really do think it's important for all Iowans to understand all of the various stories and how we connect to those, or how they may be different than the perspectives we currently know. So this is what's really exciting about this exhibit, is taking that long view of our state and telling those stories that people may or may not know, and get them curious about Iowa history, so that they, if they want to do a little bit deeper dig with us, that we have other opportunities for them with our various resources, like the Annals of Iowa, our digital collections that they can access online, or even our youngest historians. We have different programs for them, but get them curious and start asking questions about our history.
Well, and Leo, I have to think that there's just a whole lot that we don't know about that time. There was a long period of time when we weren't even asking questions about that time. Is this a part of our history that you feel that there's a lot left to uncover?
I wouldn't say a lot less. You think of the work that, like, the Office of the State Archaeologist is doing, and our State Historic Preservation Office, and working with Native Nations. We had Lance Foster kick off the year with Indians of Iowa, and Lance is someone you've had on the show, and an enrolled member of the Iowa Nation of Kansas, and he did a great job covering his book, the Native Peoples of Iowa, the Indians of Iowa. And so if listeners haven't gone back, it's archived on YouTube. Track down the Iowa 101 by Lance Foster, just as a way, as Susan said, to get some background and then dig more. But there's so much material. It's what we struggle with, too, that we can't include everything and can't even read everything or study everything.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are marking the 175th anniversary of Iowa's statehood this hour. We're getting a preview of the new Iowa People and Places exhibit at the State Historical Museum, covering nearly 13,000 years of history. And with me from the State Historical Society of Iowa, Leo Landis and Susan Claver. We will continue our conversation in a moment and listen to a little bit of the Iowa corn song. This is Talk of Iowa. Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa is marking the 175th anniversary of statehood this year. Iowa became a state on December 28th, 1846. And Leo, that day that Iowa became a state, the President of the United States didn't think much of importance was happening. But of course, that was a pretty big moment for people here in Iowa. What do you think is important to understand about being granted statehood?
And just as a quick, and I'll be quick on this one, Charity. So I've done a little bit of research. Up until the 1920s, a lot of Iowans did call our state Iowa, and that's why when Meredith Wilson does Music Man, there's the little segue there. So Dennis's comment on Iowa, like, it was that first and second generations of Iowans that was almost like the Missouri-Missouri debate. There was an Iowa-Iowa debate that was done by about 1925.
Do you feel like it's fully settled?
That's about when it becomes fully settled. So, you know, if we were 120 years ago, we would have been hearing Iowa a decent amount. But thinking about what statehood meant, you know, we had to propose a constitution and we had to have borders It is Iowa History Month. We do that in March, and we know that's another important milestone for Women's History Month, too. But the bill to make Florida and Iowa a state was introduced actually in 1845, March 3rd. So we're just 176 years and a day past that. But our borders were actually extending up to Minnesota at the time. We're going to have a program by Dr. Paul Anderson later this spring on Iowa's borders as well. But our first effort at becoming a state in 1845 goes down because Congress doesn't want to make us as big as proposed in that March 1845 bill.
So we had to be a little bit smaller. It's so interesting to think about how the people who were making those decisions were really just making it up as they went along, these decisions that have impacted so many people for so very long. Was there a reason that Iowa couldn't be so big?
There was mostly the fear that it would be tough. There were a couple of reasons. Tough to govern a state that big, and also the idea that it would possibly add down the road more representatives from a northern state that would be counter to a southern state where people were enslaved. So those two arguments were part of the reason why Congress didn't want a state as big as was initially proposed by Iowa. And then once statehood is achieved on 1846, you know, our Congress and Iowa House and Senate governor then, you know, start administering laws for our state beginning in 1847. But the constitution that we have from 1857 is really the shaping constitution for our state, not that 1840s constitution.
Well, and of course, you know, we refer a lot to the intentions of the founders of our nation, but as these states were added, as new territories were added, as the westward movement progressed, the United States was constantly morphing and being shaped. And when Iowa entered the Union as a state, this was a moment where there were a lot of debates about what the future of our nation would be like. You mentioned that it was a northern state, a non-slave state. I mean, this was a pivotal moment for the United States and our entire future, wasn't it?
It certainly was, and you know, we sometimes forget some of the racist practices in our own state, where we had segregated schools in Iowa through the 1850s and efforts into the 1870s in spite of the Clark case of 1868. So racist laws and sexist laws, women don't have the right to vote in our state till 1920. So those are some of the things we consider as we tell stories or other peoples that have been in our state for a long time. You know, Latino communities that have been here since the early 1900s but are often overlooked, or even some of the stories of Asian Iowans or Iowans with Asian ancestry. So looking at those stories and realizing, you know, some of the ripples of our past, how they continue to shape us today, too, are things we consider.
We're getting a preview of the exhibit Iowa People and Places at the State Historical Museum, covering 13,000 years of Iowa history. And Leo Landis is here, curator of the State Historical Museum, Susan Claver, administrator with the State Historical Society. And Susan, I would love to hear your thoughts. We're going to talk about some of the other things that we can see in this exhibit and, of course, other moments in Iowa history throughout the rest of the hour. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions, too, at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Susan, I know you've worked in museums for a long time. And what do you think is powerful about seeing these artifacts, interacting with artifacts, as opposed to just reading or hearing about history?
Well, I think what is exciting for me whenever we open a new museum exhibit, it is the real thing. The artifact that you were looking at was at that moment in history. And so just to stand there in the presence and to reflect on whether that was last year, 20 years ago, 50, 100 years ago, I think is incredibly powerful. And while we can provide so many different resources for learners of all types, just being in the presence of Iowa history is something that I find incredibly impactful. And I think we see that with the visitors that come in for any of our exhibits of all ages, what it actually means to look at that artifact, see, you know, potentially on that paper, a smudge, a raindrop, whatever it might be, to show that moment in history.
And to really touch the people who were also part of that moment in history. And Susan, the State Historical Museum, many museums, of course, in the state are closed right now, but the State Historical Museum is open, so people can come see this exhibit, right?
We are open, and we're open Tuesday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. We have some processes in place to make sure everyone's safe, but we are open to the public and encourage everyone to come and check out this new exhibit along with our other exhibits. We're really excited about this one because of that 13,000-year history span. And so especially with spring break coming up, I'm sure many Iowans are looking to stay within the state. And so we just welcome visitors of all ages to come experience this really powerful Iowa history exhibit.
And Leo, I think from the very start of statehood, there was an effort to create a sort of Iowan identity. And again, this was an identity formed by the people who came and settled the state of Iowa. Most of the people who were here before the settlers had been forced out of the state by that time. But one of the things that you have in your collection is a poster of Iowa, a map by Mildred Peltzer of Iowa City. And this was made in 1934. And I feel like it springs out of that urge to create sort of an Iowa identity. What do you think we can learn from looking at this poster? What's on it?
This is a fabulous piece. And Mildred Peltzer is Mary Bennett, my colleague in Iowa City. Now, she's the one that turned me onto this map. Mildred was artist and a historian who was living in Iowa City. She, as part of the run-up to the centennial of the territory in 1838, did a fabulous map. It probably has close to 200 different little items on it, and it is very Eurocentric. It looks at a lot of stories of people with European ancestry, but it has a decent amount of and sometimes sympathetic treatments toward American Indians. Blackhawk and Keokuk get mentioned. One of the stories that I just rediscovered on it, or discovered for myself, is Dixie Wilson of Mason City. She had a younger brother, Robert Meredith Wilson, who was well known. But Dixie was an important author in her own right. And so she gets a little call out. And I think if it was, a man doing that map in 1934, it wouldn't have had as many stories connected to women. I mean, there's Carrie Chapman Catt and some of those other stories that we think of with Iowa women, but some really great ones like Dixie Wilson, who most of us have forgotten about. So it's a chance when people come to see the exhibit just to explore. We own the poster both in Iowa City and in Des Moines. The poster's on display in another section, but we have an enlargement that makes it a little easier to see. And so you could spend probably 45 minutes just looking through the map, looking at different events in Iowa history.
You, of course, have a tremendous archive at the State Historical Museum, and many things that, you know, not everything can be on display all the time. So one of the things that is on display right now as part of this exhibit is something that I believe I got to see in the basement, Leo, at History Camp a couple of years ago. But this was the flag for the first colored regiment of Iowa. This dates back to the Civil War. Tell me about that.
It's a flag that we had on exhibit a few years ago, on a flag exhibit, but didn't really give it the prominence that we think it, know it deserves. I shouldn't say think, we know it deserves. In 1861, when the United States is engaged in a civil war, Alexander Clark of Muscatine approaches Governor Kirkwood and says, there are men of color in our state who are ready to fight on behalf of the Union and help defend our nation. Governor Kirkwood denies them that ability. And so when the Emancipation Proclamation is issued in 1863, that allows black soldiers then to join the Union Army. Clark and others raise more than 200 Iowa black men, more than 200 Missouri black men also join that regiment. It turns out to be about 1,000 men total. And they serve on behalf of the union. Black women of Muscatine and Keokuk make the flag for this regiment, and that was pretty typical for women to make flags for Iowa regiments. But the fact that it was a group of black women who made this flag to honor the men who were serving on behalf of our state, even though they didn't have the same rights as people with European ancestry, it's a really important artifact, and it does have some damage, but it was conserved in the 1970s. The canton, the blue section that says 1st Colored Regiment of Iowa, is in great shape, and it realizes that people in our state, from our state and across the nation, really, you know, have always been willing to fight to expand liberty and the rights that we have. And to me, it's one of the most important artifacts in our collection.
Seeing that flag was for me one of those moments where literally I got goosebumps looking at it and hearing that story. And I let Susan have a moment to talk about the importance of seeing these artifacts and actually having the opportunity to be in the presence of something that was so important and has such a rich story behind it. Leo, what do you want to add to that, though? I mean, obviously, these artifacts are a huge, huge part of your life and work.
It's inspiring to me, and it's provocative to me, and in a lot of cases, it teaches me empathy. I mean, I think about, and we may get to Gene Robinson's track suit from and track jacket from Iowa State, but when you don't necessarily have the opportunity as some people, and yet you keep trying to achieve or trying to expand the idea of what it means to be an Iowan with the ability to be educated and the ability to vote easily. I think those are things that really shape us. And those are the things that Alexander Clark was fighting for in the 1860s and what have continued. You know, you think of our state motto, our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain. And those are two things I think are important for us to think about as historians, and how do we keep guaranteeing those activities?
Of course, Iowa was flooded with immigrants from mostly from Europe, but from many different parts of the world. And the people who came to Iowa looking for opportunity and a new life, they brought things with them. You have some artifacts from the old country as well. You have a Dutch Bible that dates back to the 1600s?
Correct. A family, the Van Wyck family, who came over from the Netherlands, brought one of their family Bibles with them. It actually came from a co-worker's family, Kay Coates. Their family was looking what to do, and her maiden name is Van Wyck, and looking what to do with a family Bible they had from the mid-1600s. So, you know, here's an artifact that was about 200 years old. Plus, when the family came to Iowa, they lived in Marion County. No surprise, though, Orange City up in Sioux County is also a great Dutch community. But they lived in Marion and Jasper County, and so it's what they kept their family genealogy, their personal history in. And Dorothy Schweder, and I'll wrap this point up really quick, who was one of my professors at Iowa State, the premier Iowa historian of the 20th and early 21st century, you know, she talked to me about, and my classmates in grad school, about there's no more important factor in Iowa history than religion. And I firmly believe that it's what has shaped our state in many ways. There are many other factors, but into the 20th century, religion played such a big part in our state's history.
Well, and you mentioned Dorothy Schweder. You mentioned earlier also the Iowa History Book Club, and it's her book, The Iowa, the Middle Land, that is the book for that book club meeting, which is coming up very soon, March 11th. This is a history. Again, we may have an even broader view of history than Dorothy did when she was writing that book, but she did so much to fill in the details and tell stories that hadn't been told.
She did. She was a great historian of black Iowans with the work she did on Buxton, a great historian of the Amish communities of Iowa, and also just a great historian in general of women's stories, a real champion there too. And she actually did a really great article that kind of references that point on tensions in our state. She was actually loaned copies of letters from a family involved in Klan activity in Northwest Iowa and published an Annals of Iowa article on that. And so when you think about, again, religion and faith traditions, that was wrapped up in Iowa's Klan activity of the 1920s. So Dorothy could cover all kinds of stories. And if listeners want some good Iowa history, just pick up anything Dorothy Schweder did.
Well, and I think that also speaks to the importance of telling stories that, that some people might prefer to be forgotten. That's an important part of learning our history, even if it doesn't make you feel proud, right?
Exactly. That's part of that, you know, provocative part of Iowa history where you may not want to think about it in a particular way, and yet there have been, you know, things that should serve as lessons for us too as people who study Iowa history. And Dr. Schweder, she was just a fabulous person who wasn't afraid about taking on difficult topics in Iowa history, and that's one of the things that we think is important too.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me this hour, Leo Landis and Susan Claver of the State Historical Society of Iowa. We're talking about the Iowa People and Places exhibit at the State Historical Museum, covering nearly 13,000 years of Iowa history. And there are so many events going on this month, Iowa History Month, and this year to mark the 175th anniversary of statehood. Be sure to check out the Iowa History 101 online presentations. There's one today at noon about Ink Paducah in Iowa and many other events coming up throughout the state or throughout the month. So be sure to check that out online. And this is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
The way Iowans consume news has changed a lot since the coronavirus pandemic hit in 2020. But people here still need to know what's going on in the state every day. What are leaders saying?
The virus isn't going away until we have a vaccine.
How are medical professionals reacting, and how is it affecting hospital staff and schools?
Those weekends where you are on the phone and sending emails and, you know, dealing with people with a very emotional issue has been really hard.
I'm Clay Masters. In 2021, Iowa Public Radio is starting a podcast called Here First. It's a quick daily show for your work week that catches you up on state news as you begin your day. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters.
Most of the improvement in the unemployment picture comes from more than 90,000 Iowans no longer looking for work.
Find out when high-profile politicians are in the state.
Back at the state fair!
Learn about what's going on in state government and discover Iowans you might not hear about otherwise.
This is the first time I've spoken with a woman without documents who's also unafraid of sharing her story on the radio.
Subscribe to Iowa Public Radio's Here First wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking about Iowa history this hour. This year, we are marking 75 years of statehood in Iowa. And there's also an exhibit at the State Historical Museum all this year that will take you through Iowa history, 13,000 years of it, Iowa People and Places, again at the State Historical Museum, which is open. And with me this hour to mark 175 years of statehood, historian Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum and other historic sites in Iowa, and Susan Claver, an administrator with the State Historical Society. I've also put up a link on Twitter to the Iowa History 101 series. You can also easily find that online to find out about some of the great programs coming your way this month during Iowa History Month. And as we make our way through the Iowa People and Places exhibit, you mentioned a few minutes ago with Dorothy Schweder, wonderful historian who gave so much to Iowa, that she did a great deal of writing about Buxton, Iowa. And you have an artifact from Buxton, Iowa, from Dr. Edward Carter. Tell me about him.
Sure. He's the first black man to attend University of Iowa Med School, and he grew up in Mahaska County in the Oskaloosa-Mutchikainik area. Mutchikainik was a mining town that predated Buxton as a black mining town. He was bright. He graduates from Oskaloosa High School. S. Joe Brown, who was a prominent black lawyer in Iowa, recognized that, encouraged Edward to go to University of Iowa Law School, or excuse me, Med School. He completes his degree, is the first black graduate of the Med School, and then is the one of the doctors in the integrated community of Buxton. And when Buxton closes down in the early 1920s, the family doesn't see opportunities really in our state, so they end up in Detroit, which is a growing metropolitan area based on the auto industry with a large black community. And Iowa still didn't have a large black community in 1920, so Dr. Carter moved with his wife and daughter to Detroit. And in the 1960s, his daughter donated his medical school degree, his high school diploma, a medical bag, a pair of her mom's shoes. And so we have this great collection of material connected to the Carter family of Oskaloosa area, Mahaska County. And it's really just a privilege to be able to share these stories. And we've got a great photograph of him that we use a lot, too, in Buxton. And so this is a story, again, where providing equal opportunities, sometimes our state doesn't always meet what we wish we did. And I think that's the case of Edward Carter.
That's also a history that we are continuing to write today in Iowa. And I know that when we think about historical artifacts, we probably think about things that are, you know, prior to our lives. But you have a wonderful artifact that you've acquired fairly recently that's from 1972, which is not very long ago, but here we are in Iowa History Month, in Women's History Month as well. You have a track jacket of Jean Robinson of Iowa State University. Tell me about this jacket and its significance.
We were just so touched that Jean reached out to us about a year and a half ago, now maybe 2 years ago, I guess we're in 2021. And Jean had run track as a competent high school athlete at Baxter High School, and then enrolls at Iowa State in the fall of 1972. The women's track team is a club team at that time, and so they don't get their uniforms supplied by the university. The mothers of the athletes, in many cases, sew the uniforms for them, and so Jean still had her top and her shorts that she ran with in 1972 and 1973, and then the jacket that her mother made. The jacket's in the People and Places exhibit. We do hope later this year to get our mobile museum, the Iowa History 101 Mobile Museum, back out on the road in her shorts and top that her mother made for her because the university was not supplying their uniforms. And then that track team, that cross-country team, is nationally significant. They win the National Cross-Country Championship once it's launched, and Jean was a manager for a lot of those women. So just a really great story about how in the pre-Title IX era, women were looking to have the same opportunities as men were in college athletics.
I feel like that piece also tells us about Jean's mother as well, because it's an incredibly well-made jacket, and you can just see the love and skill that was put into the jacket and the top and the shorts. She was a seamstress, right?
That's correct. She really was a top-notch sewing artist. Is really, she would be like so many Iowa women, and there are some men who sew too, but who grew up sewing. Alice Robinson just was an expert seamstress, so won a National Grange Award, the Patrons of Husbandry, the rural support group. So Alice Robinson, who is now deceased, but she made a number of things, of course, for the family, and so we've got a few other pieces in our collection from Alice Robinson that Jean donated to us. Jean lives in Iowa City now, so we're grateful to her.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about some of the other artifacts that tell the stories of Iowa women. You also have a name badge for the first woman on the Iowa Supreme Court.
And that's one I shared with you. We do also have Justice Newman's robe, too, that she had, and her briefcase is in the exhibit. Justice Linda Newman of Scott County from the Davenport-LeClaire area, she was our first woman on the Iowa Supreme Court, appointed in late 1986. And so the briefcase that she has was actually a Christmas gift. She had been a district judge, but she was practicing in Scott County when she did that, so she didn't have to travel as much. But once she joins the Supreme Court, her husband for that Christmas of 1986 gives her a briefcase with her name on it that says Justice Linda Newman. So we've got her name badge that says Justice Linda Newman. We've got her briefcase and her robe in the exhibit in Iowa People and Places.
Making history, and not so very long ago.
No, 1986, so in a lot of your listeners' lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. let's fast forward a little bit to the 1990s, which, again, is so very recent. But there have been so many significant things going on in Iowa in the last few decades. We're going to skip over the Iowa farm crisis, which, of course, is an incredibly important part of Iowa history. And there will be many programs in the future, again, on the farm crisis in Iowa, because it continues to shape us in such powerful ways. But I want to kind of skip through that today. And let's talk about a Hmong scarf that you have in your collection from the 1990s. Tell me about this.
Showa Herr, who, again, we seem to be on Mahaska County today, but lived in Oskaloosa and is still there, came in the 1980s. And like a lot of the Hmong refugees from Southeast Asia, many came in the 1970s too. She, in the 1990s, was continuing to practice some of her traditional Hmong textiles. And so we have a scarf and also a story cloth that she made that tells the story of the Hmong people coming, or at least her experience and some of her friends and family coming to Iowa. So a scarf that's just exquisitely made, but also a story cloth that visually tells the story of Hmong refugees coming to Iowa.
Well, and it is exciting to think about the different groups of people that have come to Iowa in the last few decades. We seem to go through waves where many people from one part of the world will come at one time. Of course, we have many Sudanese Iowans. We have many Bosnian Iowans. We have Congolese Iowans. We have so many groups of people who have come here and brought such rich culture with them. So it's wonderful to see that as part of this exhibit, because it continues to shape Iowa and will continue to shape Iowa in the future. I want to talk about some more recent history. Of course, floods have been an incredibly powerful part of our history for a long time, especially since 1993. We've had so many enormous and historic floods since then. Tell me a little bit about how that's represented.
In the People and Places exhibit, we have a couple of items connected to the floods of 1993, primarily Des Moines-oriented in this case, but we do know one of the photographs we feature is the Mississippi River at Burlington, with just the devastation along the riverfront there. But we have a can opener that was sent to Des Moines from a church in Arkansas. So you think of simple artifacts like that that can represent how people across the nation reached out to Iowans, or we do have materials from the 2019 flood as well, and that's one of the things for listeners we do. We try to represent the whole state, and so having things from places like Hamburg in southwest Iowa, down in Mills County, and just how destructive the 2019 flood was for people along the Missouri River. Again, painful parts of our history, but stories we want to tell. And so if there are listeners across the state who have materials, you know, please do reach out to us, especially from more recent communities that have been established in our state.
I think that until this year, maybe a lot of us haven't spent a lot of time thinking about the fact that we are living history in every moment. Of course, there are those historic moments that we remember from life, like when the Berlin Wall came down and things like that, that they really grab a world's attention or a nation's attention. But here we are in 2020, 2021, and we are living in this year that is so remarkable and so historic. As a historian, Leo, how do you think about the present moment when these events are going on? I mean, you have a different perspective on this, I think.
And this goes for Becky Plunkett, my colleague in Special Collections here in Des Moines, and Mary Bennett in Iowa City, Tony Jan, our state archivist. We're always thinking about what are the things we need to add to help Iowans tell stories in the future and to represent people from all across the state. And so I think about, you know, one of the things we had, we still are collecting materials connected to the last year and a half and to what's happening in our country today. And a donor gave us an egg carton that had been purchased at an Iowa grocery store that came from a farm down in Davis County. It was a family farm that markets their own eggs through Iowa grocery stores. And they, inside their egg carton in March and April, were putting in little photocopied messages from their family saying, you know, what a crisis we have. We have a cold morning. The girls are packing eggs every day to try and meet the needs of our stores and customers. Thank you for trying our eggs. Those of you who haven't gotten ours before, we hope you will like them and want to support our small family farm. A big thank you. So this is an Amish family from Davis County who was putting in a little message that references what was happening in our state in the spring of 2020. And so those are the sorts of little nuggets of stories that we just love being able to collect and share.
We have this moment right now. Of course, we're coming, this whole month really is the anniversary of the beginning of the pandemic in most people's lives. I really mark it on March 13th because that's the day that the schools all closed. But as people are thinking back on that year, I've seen a lot of people reflecting on, you know, this is the moment when I realized that things had changed, or this is my last normal picture from my photo stream and that kind of thing. Leo, what do you want people to think about when they are looking at these stories and memories? Are there things that we should be making sure to write down or collect in a way?
I think those stories of just disruption, but also the continuity that we've tried to experience too. And then those are some of the themes, continuity and change. When you think about any people's history, those are two things we look at. You know, what have we been able to maintain? What have we changed that has made us better, we hope? And perhaps to a degree, you know, what lessons have we learned that we will do differently in the future? You know, you think of history and the stories that we're experiencing now, and to reflect on those for just a moment and say, would that be a good fit for the State Historical Society of Iowa? And we hope you'll think of us so that we can share those stories in the future.
Another important story that you are telling in this exhibit just from the last year is you've collected artifacts from some of the Black Lives Matter rallies and gatherings that were held throughout 2020.
That's right. And we have some materials from Des Moines rallies, but one that became aware of through Ty Rushing, who's a former reporter up in Northwest Iowa. He was involved in the rally in Spencer that took place on June 5th or June 6th. And Ty Jackson, who's a young man, young Black man up there, he and a friend, Brock Storm, were part of the rally. Brock is an artist from Spencer as well, and was able to connect with them and get materials from the Spencer Black Lives Matter rally. And it was, you know, over 500 people in, you know, nice-sized Iowa county seat town where we don't always think about social justice issues. And yet Ty, as a Black man growing up there, certainly had experienced racism. And so we're really grateful to be able to tell that story from across the state.
I'm also eager for you to, in the future, tell the story of how vaccination ended this pandemic. That is my dearest hope. But Leo, what an extraordinary time to be studying history and sharing it with others. Tell me more. The Iowa People and Places exhibit, will this be on display throughout 2021?
It will, and we'll rotate some things off and on after about a year. So if you want to see the 1st Colored Regiment flag of Iowa come in the next, 8 months, to be sure you'll see it. Textiles are fragile, so are pen and ink drawings by American Indians. So if you want to see the Waukesha piece, be here in the next, 8 months to see it. And that point you made, I need to figure out how to reach out to either University of Iowa hospitals or some other Iowa hospital to see if I can get an empty vial of Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So
all right.
if anybody has any leads on that.
Get in touch with Leo Landis, please. Leo Landis, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure, Charity.
Historian Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum. Susan Claver, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Susan Claver, administrator with the State Historical Society. We've been talking about the Iowa People and Places exhibit at the State Historical Museum all year long, covering nearly 13,000 years of history as we mark 175 years of statehood this year. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Iowa, winter, spring, summer, and fall.